Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you around the world, and a warm welcome as I bring you another edition to the Answers for the Family radio show. I am your guest host and international kindness expert, Gabriella Van Rey. As the founder of the Dare to Be Kind movement, I know firsthand the power of one single act of kindness. I have seen it everywhere. Through stories and interview, we showcase that first of all, that everyone has a story, and we showcase that, secondly, that each story has a vulnerable part, and in the vulnerable part, we actually find kindness. Through these stories, most of us do not feel so alone, and the emotions resonate with everyone. And hopefully through these stories, we create a safer world. And according to Alan, making me a perfect fit to host today's show in his absence. I have now been a guest or a guest co-host a few times, and I've learned that Alan really looks at this show as a way for all of us to make a positive difference in the lives of others. And he really needs your help to become show ambassadors who will forward at least one show on your social media timeline or group so that someone else can benefit from a particular subject. Each week, the show will address issues such as locating your runaway teens, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addiction, increasing our quality of life and longevity, and so much more. Alan has told me that he and Jan Chapin, the show producer, choose top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors that they believe are working to make this world a better place for all. And today's topic is, can adverse childhood experiences cause addiction? We are welcoming John to the show, and he says that according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, adverse childhood experiences have been linked to risky health behaviors, chronic health conditions, and even early death. Joining us today to speak on this topic is John Mabry. He is a national addiction advocate, award-winning speaker, inventor, actor, and stuntman who has his master's in counseling and hosts Addiction Campuses, high sobriety podcast. He has worked on TV shows like NCIS and ER and the movie Superbad, among others. His work has been featured in People magazine, USA Today, and Access Hollywood, and countless other outlets. John, welcome to the Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor to be here today. Thank you, Gabriella. Well,
I am so glad that I'm able to ask you the questions, because I am so interested in your topic. So let's start, before we start with tons of questions, let's start with your personal story, because as you heard me say earlier, we all have one. What is yours?
Yeah, so I would love to start off by saying, so when people hear your introduction to adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs as they're called, those can be traumatic. I'd love to just kind of qualify that real quick.
Okay.
And those can be stressful or traumatic events, including abuse or neglect. They can be, bullying, household dysfunction, witnessing a domestic violence experience growing up with members in their family. Adverse childhood experiences can also be growing up in a household where somebody with a mental health or a substance abuse issue was present in the home. So I know when I first heard adverse childhood experiences, I was kind of like, okay, that doesn't really pertain to me, because I had kind of what I thought was a normal childhood. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But I'd love to, I just want to qualify that for listeners that maybe just open your mind to what maybe consider an adverse childhood experience. Maybe it's something as simple as going through a childhood operation, a surgery, maybe diagnosed as cancer. Those are things that can be considered. You're really setting the tone for a life, a lifetime of substance abuse or addiction based on an early childhood experience. So just kind of want to leave listeners with that to hang on to before I get into my story.
Thank you so much for doing that. That's very helpful.
Yeah, exactly. And having an adverse childhood experience can lead to, like you said, it can lead to worst case scenario, suicide and early death. It can lead to diabetes. It can lead to heart disease. It can lead to, a host of, major chronic diseases later on in life, if not addressed. And I thought that that was kind of, witchcraft or kind of like, right. Yes. Somebody goes through something as a child, you learn to deal with it and you shake it off and you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you move on with life and everything is okay. And if you can't deal with it later on in life as an adult, then you're just weak. That's what I always thought. But I've learned to understand in my experiences that it's not so easy. It's not that easy.
Okay.
So let me dive a little bit into my story. So I grew up as I would categorize it as a privileged childhood in South Texas, in San Antonio. I had a wonderful childhood. I had a wonderful set of parents. And multiple, both sets of grandparents were very well established and very well known. And things were just easy. Things came easy to me as a child. And I ended up going into high school. High school was easy for me. I went into college at Baylor University, I was grateful to have a private collegiate education provided for me. And it was all under the Baptist church. It was all under, a Christian umbrella. And so you would think somebody brought up under a Christian umbrella who had everything provided for him might not have any reason to become a raging alcoholic or addict like I ended up becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And, things were rolling into my senior year in college. I was so blessed to have a great group of friends. I was in a fraternity. I was social chair of our fraternity. I was dating a cheerleader for the school who was our fraternity sweetheart. And I had a full ride scholarship my senior year. I had earned a full ride scholarship through some of my schoolwork. And so I had everything just kind of rolling for me. And I set up a spring break cruise for me and my friends to go out of New Orleans on a cruise down to Mexico. And we get done with this booze cruise. Like 40 of us, and we just had this great time, and we're driving back from New Orleans back to Waco, Texas, and the unthinkable happened. I'm 22 years old, and a tire blew out my friend's SUV, and we rolled about 10 times. Witness reports say the car rolled over and over and over and over and over and over again across the interstate on I-45 outside of Houston, Texas, and those 7 or 8 seconds changed my entire life. Long story short, I ended up having my legs got out the window and got crushed numerous times. And, I had a friend die in the accident and I ended up having 14 surgeries that year.
Wow.
And here I am coming from a well-to-do family with, all the, resources and love and compassion that could, anybody could ever want coming out of a major car accident. And I go into these 14 surgeries and I come out with some painkillers and those painkillers really changed everything. I was given a prescription from a doctor. Everything was legal. I wasn't, going to the street for cocaine or heroin. I was just given some painkillers and I took those. And as soon as I ended up having my leg amputated after those 14 surgeries that year. So you take a kid who had everything going for him to having his leg amputated, moving from college to, all the freedom that I ever wanted to moving back home with my parents and having my mom, change my urinal every night, it was just, it was a whole different way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I became disconnected, and we'll talk about disconnection a little bit further as we move forward in this talk. But really, the disconnection from my life before to my life now is what set the tone for those painkillers to take control of my life. Is now I'm no longer connected with the life that I knew, and next thing you know, I'm turning those painkillers to fill that void. And on the surface, man, I wanted everything to look great, because that's how I was kind of brought up. Is everything's got to look good on the surface. And I go and have my leg amputated. I graduate college. I move off from Texas to San Diego to work on a master's in counseling. And as I'm working on my master's in counseling, I got married, and I'm doing fundraising for nonprofit organizations. I'm doing triathlons on one leg. Now all of a sudden I'm doing things I never thought I would do, like skydiving, and I get done with great. Yeah. You know, it's like, but you know, fueling all of that was this disconnection and this addiction, and the addiction slipped in with that disconnection. And not only was I addicted to the painkillers, I was going to doctors. I was driving down to Tijuana getting pain. You know, I was getting medicine from illegally from Tijuana and bringing it up, you know, from the border in San Diego. And I couldn't focus in school, in graduate school, because of the painkillers and the marijuana and the alcohol that I was drinking. So next thing you know, I'm on Adderall, and so I got a prescription for Adderall, which, you know, you think coming from a doctor, from a prescription from a doctor is not that bad. Well, next thing you know, I'm taking, you know, 30 days of Adderall in 7 or 8 days, and I'm not sleeping for days at a time. And then I can't sleep for days at a time, so I'm on sleeping pills. Mm-hmm. And I'm on, you know, I'm passing out on Ambien in the middle of my living room. So it just fueled this, like, constant, like, cocktail of substances underneath my system that I had to have at all times.
And did your doctors cope with life. Did your doctors know about this, John?
No, because I'm lying to all of them. Or I'm not, okay. I'm not being honest with myself. Mm-hmm. And two, I'm not being honest with the doctors. And I'm not being honest with my wife and my family members. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everybody's losing in this case. It's, man, if I was just honest with myself first and foremost, that would have been the easiest thing to do. But it was just too hard, because I was dealing with so much post-traumatic stress. I was dealing with so much anxiety and depression. And, you know, I'm not who I used to be. Physically, I look different. I have a robot leg. You know, kids are talking about me in the, you know, walking down the aisle in the grocery store, and kids are going, "Mom, look at that guy," which, yeah, I didn't mind talking to. I don't mind, like, I love wearing shorts, and I don't mind, you know, talking about it. But at the same time, I felt like a freak. You know, I just felt different. I didn't feel normal. And so it just kept getting worse and worse over time. And sure enough, long story short, like I said, I ended up graduating graduate school, and I fell into some acting work. And I moved up to LA from San Diego, and I dragged my wife kicking and screaming, because I got in People magazine as a filling in for a body double for my cousin, who's an actor. Mm-hmm. And that led to all kinds of, you know, NCIS and ER and Cold Case and JAG and all kinds of, you know, high profile shows and media interviews. And next thing you know, I'm hanging out backstage at the ESPYs with The Rock and, yeah, you know, Penny Marshall and all these A-listers. And next thing you know, I'm at the Playboy Mansion with Adam Sandler. And that was like the pinnacle. That was like, when I'm at the Playboy Mansion with Adam Sandler and Hugh Hefner, man, I had a ride.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, what kid doesn't from, you know, South Texas doesn't want to get blown up on Hollywood set and go to the Playboy Mansion? You know, you sign me up. I'm there. And I signed up for it, and I was completely distraught. I was completely erratic. I was not present for any of it because of my addictions. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just a few short months after that party at the Playboy Mansion with Emma Stone and Bruce Willis and Adam Sandler that I got a call that my brother, who is my best friend and my only sibling, he didn't show up for work one day to his job. He worked right across the street from the Man Chinese Theater right there at Hollywood Highland. Mm-hmm. And that was not like him. He had his MBA from Georgetown, brilliant guy, bright mind. Again, came from the same family, came from the same, you know, grandparents and parents.
Mm-hmm.
But he struggled with addiction, and we did not want to, we didn't want to talk about it. We didn't want people to think that we as a family struggled with this kind of stuff because of the stigma. Stigma was really, really what held us back. And so my brother struggled with it for years, and sure enough, he didn't show up for work one day. And I went over to his house in Beverly Hills, and I went to his bedroom door, and I went to open the door, and it was locked. And I called his cell phone one more time, and I heard his cell phone ringing from the other side of the door, and there was no answer. So the only thing I knew to do was to kick the door in. And so I kicked the door in with my prosthetic leg, and I stepped from one trauma that I already had into another trauma, and I found my brother dead from an overdose. And, you know, it's just, it doesn't have to happen. We don't have to keep having, like in 2016, we had 64,000 Americans die of an overdose.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's from the stigma. A lot of it's from, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want people to think that, you know, our households are dealing with this kind of stuff, but we are. And we don't talk about it. That's why I talked about it today.
May I ask you a question? Did you know about your brother's addiction?
We did, yeah. Yeah, we all did.
Okay.
He had sobered up for a year and a half. He was going to 12-step meetings. He was going to therapy, and he had sobered up for a year and a half, but he drank. Whenever he drank, then he did cocaine, and then he did other things. And so he drank for the first time in a year and a half at a wedding, and he told us about it. He said, hey, I had some alcohol. I just want to let you guys know. But we didn't know the power. We didn't understand the power of it. And one drink led to 2 weeks later, him overdosing on drugs. And so it's that important that people not only one, say that they're struggling, two, go get help, and three, stay in a recovery program long-term, because it just takes one slip to overdose.
But what is that cause of that addiction? Before I even want to ask what's the cause of the slip, but what is the cause of the addiction? Because you touched on disconnection there, right?
Yeah, disconnection. So there's a theory out there, it's a scientific theory. If anybody out there is interested, they can go to Addiction Campuses Network. So one, I want to go back to the fact that I work for Addiction Campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And addictioncampuses.com is a great resource to go to. Addiction Campuses Network on YouTube has some great videos on this. And one of them is there's a theory of addiction that states that it's a disconnection. And
okay.
if you look at the information, if you look at scientific studies that show there's a rat. They put a rat inside of a cage, and they gave it water, or they gave it an option of having water laced with heroin or cocaine. And every single time a rat is in a cage by itself, it's going to go for the drug-laced water. Every single time, it's going to compulsively go for it, and it's going to overdose. It's going to kill itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so we used to think decades ago that it was like chemical hook in the drug. Well, the chemical hook keeps that rat coming back, right? Mm-hmm. Well, there's a psychologist went and looked at the scientific experiment. The psychologist goes, wait, well, this rat's inside a cage by itself. What happens if we put a rat inside of a cage with other rats? And what if so they built Rat Park, and it's like heaven for rats, and rats could, you know, mate with each other, and they could run down, you know, tunnels, and there was colorful balls to play with. And they gave them the same water options, water by itself or water laced with heroin or cocaine. Not once did any of the rats in Rat Park compulsively go for the water laced with heroin or cocaine, and not one rat ever overdosed.
We were meant to be together, right? Community, yes.
Connection. It's about community. It's about being connected with other people, like-minded, and that's where I believe the addiction can slip in more so than ever. And I'm a prime example of that. When I was living a life full of community and college, I had friends, I had everything I could ever want, and then all of a sudden I'm disconnected through this car accident, and painkiller slipped in, and I was off to the races. However, there's a twist to the story.
Okay.
The twist to my story is, although I went through everything that I went through to understand what I thought I knew about addiction, it wasn't until I went through multiple rounds of inpatient treatment and for me to understand that I had a trauma therapist that came up to me one day, or that I had a phone consultation with. And before I even saw her in person, she said, "Tell me what you're going through." And I said, "Well, I keep relapsing. I've been through treatment a few times. And, you know, I'm dealing with a car accident. I had my leg amputated. A friend died. And I found my brother dead from an overdose." And she was like, "Thank you for telling me all those details. But I'm not really concerned about those. What I'm concerned about is what happened to you as a child." And I was like, for the first time, I was like, "What? What are you talking about? Are you crazy?" I said, "I had a great childhood." And she goes, "I'm sure you did. What happened?" I said, "Man, you know, the only thing I can think of is that I had some ear surgeries as a kid, but that wasn't a big deal. You know, that was a long time ago. It wasn't a big deal." And she goes, no, "John, I'm here to tell you, when you come in to see me next week in our, in-office appointment, I'm here to tell you that that's where we're going to start. We're going to start with your ear surgery." She's like, "I guarantee you that's where your problem started." I said, "What?" And so I tell my wife, I was like, "This lady wants me to come and talk about my ear surgeries from 25 years ago." Sure enough. So here it is I had six ear surgeries from the time I was about age six to age 15. And I had I had tubes twice in my ears from infections. And I ended up having a transplanted eardrum in my left ear, and the three bones in my left ear, prosthetic bones, that were put in by a doctor who I had to fly out of state for. Mm-hmm. And she's like, "Do you think that didn't have anything to do with the fact that?" And I told her, I said, "Well, I've always felt insecure. I've always felt broken. I've always felt unfixable. And I don't know why." She's like, "Well, it's because from a child you felt broken and insecure and unfixable because of your ear. Like, you never felt whole." I was like, "Are you serious?" And so I told her in my senior year in high school and college, or my senior year in high school, I said, "Well, I was voted class clown, most outgoing, most school spirited, and best personality. Like, I had everything going for me." And she goes, "Yeah, because that was just a cover up, because you were broken, man. You were never really ever felt whole from a child." I was like, "Oh my gosh." And so it opened the floodgates for stuff that happened, you know, stuff that I would have never considered would affected me in my adulthood. Mm-hmm. That, man, I need to go back to the very beginning and process that. And once I was able to go back and do that and identify that as a major obstacle in my life, then things started finally opening up. Life started making more sense. Wow. And so I'm just so blessed to be able today to be able to, you know, share my story, and two, encourage people that, and something may have happened to you when you were 3 or 4 or 5 years old that you think is completely insignificant, that you don't think has anything to do with your life as a 40-year-old human being or a 50 or 60-year-old human being. But I'm here to tell you that it can set the tone for how you react to life, and how I believe on a cellular, it affected me on a cellular level that I really had to get down deep and process that kind of stuff. These adverse childhood experiences, mm-hmm. For me to be able to really deal with life on life's terms today. As a 40-year-old man.
Yeah, no, I'm personally, John, I agree totally with you. I think that a lot of issues that we have today all go back to our childhood. We unfortunately need to take a tiny little break, but for all your listeners out there, we will be right back. Thank you so much.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585 or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
Hi, everyone, and we're back. If you're just tuning in with Answers for the Family with John, who is talking about addictions and the causes and the disconnection, especially of addiction. Hey, John, I know I have a question here that I want to ask you. How were the 10 questions of the Adverse Childhood Experience questionnaire originally developed? And what are a few questions that you might tell our listeners here that would surprise them?
Yeah, so adverse childhood experiences were originally, don't quote me on the, I forget the doctor who originally studied it out of University of California, San Diego. But mm-hmm. It was originally developed by patients that he was seeing with obesity. So okay. He was having people come into the office who were obese. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, he was trying to get them to, you know, to lose weight, obviously. And next thing you know, he started asking them questions about, you started seeing individuals who were relapsing on their diet plan. And what it came down to was it wasn't because of the food itself. It was the emotional turmoil that they were going through. It was the emotional issues that they were struggling with that led them to keep eating. So you can go and I don't know the doctor's name off the top of my hand, but it was originally noticed by somebody studying obesity out of San Diego. And so some of the questions that they ask here on the ACE questionnaire nowadays is there's a 10 question questionnaire, and I'll just kind of run through a couple of them that people can look at. It says, while you were growing up during mm-hmm. the first 18 years of life, did a parent or other adult in your household often swear at you, insult you, put you down, or humiliate you, or act in a way that made you feel afraid that you might be physically hurt? So, you know, a lot of people might go, okay, yeah, I got yelled at. Yes, I got reprimanded as a child. But really, in the first 18 years of life, did you ever feel afraid that you might be physically hurt? You didn't even have to be physically hurt. You could just be afraid that you might be physically hurt. Mm-hmm. That in itself is an adverse childhood experience. Another one is, an adult.
Keep going. I'm just astounded that it could be something so little. So please keep going.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So little. Did an adult or a person at least 5 years older than you ever touch, fondle, or have you touch their body in a sexual way?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's pretty obvious that might, that even 5 years older than you, doesn't have to be, you know, a grandfather or a father or mother. It could be just somebody 5 years older than you. You know, mm-hmm. maybe it was an older brother's friend asked you to, you know, do something that was sexual in nature that caused you to maybe have a what would be considered an adverse childhood experience. Another one is, did you often feel that no one in your family loved you or thought that you were important or special?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's profound.
Yeah, it actually is. And I think by you telling the listener this, the listener is just like me. They're kind of going, wow, this small would have a long-term effect on this child as an adult. And it gives us a real pause as a parent or anyone listening to this thinking that we need to be more careful in how we approach young children, no?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this has made me more conscious in my parenting with my three children.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause we're talking 23 million children, you know, I'm sorry, 35 million children in the United States suffering from at least one traumatic childhood event. 35 million children, I'm going to repeat that, in the United States are suffering from at least one traumatic childhood event. And they could be as simple as somebody in their family never really loved them or thought that they were important or special.
Hmm. Yeah.
Another one is no one in your family or your family did not look out for each other. or feel close to each other or support each other. That's another one of the ACE or adverse childhood experience questions on the questionnaire is, did your family didn't look out for each other or feel close or support each other? I mean, it just seems kind of simple. Like, well, yeah, okay, maybe we weren't all on the same page. But really, that could have a really long-term effect on an individual if you just didn't feel supported by the people in your home.
Absolutely. You know? Hey, John, I have a few questions I would love to get in that are from people that would like to ask you a personal question here. The first one, my brother, who's 27, is a screening analyst at one of the top marijuana testing labs in our state. I was told confidentially by one of his roommates that he's dabbing in THC, which I am told is a form of consuming highly concentrated THC, like free basing marijuana. They say he comes home at lunch and then does it again every night. In addition, he smokes cigarettes and drinking a pint of whiskey every few days. Sorry. Until now, I never thought there was a connection, but he was bullied by other children until his later teens, and I believe he never got over it. How do you suggest we approach this problem as he acts like everything in his life is just going great? This is Andrea from California.
Andrea, hey, great question. And I don't know if I have just an easy answer for you. That's a really great question and probably very common. So thank you for asking that and bringing it to the show. You know, everybody's on a different level. Everybody, some people you can approach and say, hey, I'm kind of concerned about your behavior. Hey, I'm kind of concerned about some of the things that you're, you know, partaking in. I know when my wife came to me about it, my family came to me about it, I didn't want anything to do with it. I was like, what are you talking about? I don't have a problem. And it was really almost about 10 years before I experienced enough consequences that I was willing to come forward and say, I think I need help. So it's a really fine line between, hey, I want to help and I think I know from an outsider what might be going on. But there's also that, where is the individual? Are they willing to get help? Are they willing to hear it? Mm-hmm. So I think the first, you know, suggestion I would have is, depending on your relationship with, is it her brother? Would be to kind of nonchalantly bring it up and bring it up in a non-threatening way. Now, if you need to go, you know, further and bring it up in a more efficient, you know, kind of a, if you need to have an intervention kind of thing, again, that's where Addiction Campus is, who I work with, and we have treatment centers all throughout the country. If you call into our call center, we have people that can help you digest this. And I'm not a trained professional on interventions, but if you were to call our call center, that is something that that we could help you with, and we could help put you in touch with an interventionist to help you start that conversation.
But the brother needs to do that, right? Not the sister.
Not necessarily.
The sister can call the center?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so a lot of times the family members need just as much support as the person who's struggling with the addiction.
Okay.
So let's say I'm off the rails. You know, addicted to painkillers and heroin and, you know, prescription, you know, painkillers or, you know, whatever the case may be, alcohol, and I'm not willing to get help. It's so important and as important for the family members to get support as well. So that may be a 12-step program for them, maybe Al-Anon or therapy. Mm-hmm. But again, a really good first place to go is to call our call center. And we can help walk you through that to help you understand if you're somebody that if an intervention makes sense for you and your family, if really suggesting some support groups in your area for the family member or support groups or therapy or rehab centers for the individual.
Okay.
So can I give our 800 number? Is that
I was
reasonable?
Just going to ask you that.
Yeah, yep. So please give Addiction Campuses a call. We have we're taking 19,000 to 20,000 calls a month right now. So we take calls from all across the country for people needing all types of help. And so our 800 number is 888 614-2251. Again, you can go to addictioncampuses.com, Addiction Campuses, or call 888-614-2251. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, Addiction Campuses Network on YouTube has some great videos on how to help with, like, enabling. What is enabling? What does that mean? What is trauma? What does that mean? So we have some great resources available with, we have some award-winning videos out there as well, on our YouTube channel.
Thank you so much for that information, John. I have one more question that I really would like to get in from an other listener. I have four very different children between the ages of 10 and 17. Summer a year ago, we were shocked to find out our 17-year-old in need of an alcohol and drug intervention. We truly never saw it coming. And it has cost us dearly, not just with the expenses of the treatment, but the trauma that we feel for our other kids experienced while dealing with her drama and anger aimed at all of us. Even with as much counseling as we have been through, my wife and I still do not feel are equipped to guide my younger ones or see the warning signs early enough. This is George from Virginia.
Hey, George, thank you so much for writing in and for the question. That's, again, a multifaceted question. That's not an easy question to answer. But, one, I'm sorry that your family is going through the turmoil that it's going through. And it really is. So imagine, so you have children that are ages 10 through 17. Imagine if your 17-year-old was going through cancer, right? Everybody in the family is going to be affected by the fact that 17-year-old's going through cancer. It's a chronic disease that, left untreated, is going to only get worse with time and can kill. Same thing with alcoholism or addiction. It's a chronic disease that, left untreated, can kill somebody, just like it did with my brother. We left it untreated and it killed my brother, and I found him dead. Extremely traumatic. So your family's going through something that is very common these days. And you're not alone. And I would encourage you and your family to try to, get in as much therapy as you can, because you've got to, like I said from the last caller, you've got to take care of yourself. The alcoholic or the addict themselves may not be willing to get help. And until they're ready to get the help that they need, you still need to take care of you. And you still need to take care of your younger children. And so if there's a way to get into some family therapy, to some Al-Anon, some 12-step, groups for the family. Those a lot of times are free and readily available in many communities. Part of the problem is the stigma, though. I know that was a big deal with my parents. Was like, man, my parents didn't want to go to an Al-Anon meeting. My parents didn't want to go to therapy or go to go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist because their kid was struggling, because that would look bad on them. And We gotta let the stigma thing go. Just like cancer, if you have cancer, you're gonna let everybody in your community know that you have cancer, and it's okay to have cancer. If you have diabetes or heart disease, you let everybody in your community know you have diabetes or heart disease, and you'll talk about it at the dinner table. But with addiction or alcoholism, it's like, man, we don't talk about it because that just means we have a bad. It's a moral failing. We didn't do our part as a parent.
Is the reason, John, that we have such a stigma with it is because we think it's not really a disease, and so why it reflects badly, whereas cancer, feel it's something that we cannot be helped, right? Whereas addiction, well, he or she put it in their bodies, right? So
exactly.
Self-inflicted, it's not seen as a disease.
So cancer. So there's multiple types of cancer. So there's, there's bone cancer, there's breast cancer, there's brain cancer, there's skin cancer. Okay. So if you have skin cancer, and that may be self-imposed because you spend a lot of time in the sun, or you may have lung cancer or lip, cancer of the skin or in your jaw because you had, dip or tobacco. Mm-hmm. Well, even if somebody has lung cancer from smoking, we still encourage you, like, please go get help. Like, you're going to die if you don't go get help for your lung cancer. You're going to die if you don't get help for your skin cancer, even though you spent time in the sun. and that was kind of your fault. But we don't look at it that way. But with addiction, we go, well, you're the one putting the drugs in your body. Well, look underneath the surface of that. The reason somebody may put drugs or alcohol in their body is because they were traumatized as a child. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever knew it. And they're just trying to, you know, the drugs or alcohol aren't the problem. It's the emotional distress that's really the problem. And somebody's just covering up that emotional distress for years and years and years. And now it's coming out as alcohol or drug problem. But we look at them as having a moral failing or a lack of willpower.
And would you say that all the, see, because I really don't know this, all the treatment centers in the U.S., would you say that they take that same attitude as your therapist did by saying, okay, what happened to you as a child, instead of just focusing on the pure addiction side and how to get you off? Does every treatment center go there to that part, or should they do that through the addiction campuses?
Great question. No, absolutely not. So there are roughly between 11 and 14,000 treatment center options that people have in the U.S. today. And so that could be either residential inpatient, that could be outpatient facilities, and so on and so forth. But my last treatment center that I went to was Addiction Campus of Treatment. I went to a high, you know, I've been out to the Playboy Mansion and lived in L.A. and did that whole high life. And I went to a high-end celebrity treatment center in Tucson, Arizona, and I drank 3 days after getting out of that place. It didn't do it for me. It didn't get down deep. It didn't get down to the root cause. And it wasn't until I went to an addiction campus's treatment facility that they really started digging beneath the surface and have the personnel to care and the compassion, the compassionate heart. And you think most treatment centers would have a compassionate heart, and they don't. I've been to 4 centers, and addiction campuses was my last one. And it had the most compassionate staff on hand to be able to deal with my deep traumatic past. And I just had a much better experience in the last 2.5 years since coming out of our treatment center.
That's why I'm asking you this question, because I think for the listener, this is really, really important, because you get discouraged with yourself. You know what I mean? Whether, like you said, whether we have an addiction with food, or we have an addiction with drugs, we have addiction with alcohol. There's so many different addictions.
Yeah, sex and shopping and,
But I really do feel that people get very frustrated because we put so much hope, the whole family, you and your family, put so much hope in a treatment center, whereas the way I am listening to you, and my reaction is almost, let's get everyone that needs help immediately to the addiction campuses, because I'm all for looking at the underlying problem, which is harder to dig through, but has a lasting impact for you in your life with your family to grow from. Am I seeing that right? I mean, no pun intended here, because I mean, it's always good that you go somewhere for help. But I almost wish that the listener would feel the reaction that I'm having to our conversation and listening to you is just, we need to go to that underlying part and not just say, okay, let's get the drugs fixed, or let's get the alcohol fixed. Let's go to deeper, no matter how hard it is.
Yes, yes, and you're so right. And here's one thing that helps the listener. So, a lot of times you'll go to a treatment center that has 30 or 60 or 90 days. Okay, so you can only do so much work in a 30 or 60 or 90 day treatment center, which we do and we offer, and we're going to get down to a more compassionate level of care than our competitors at addiction campuses. But we take things a step further, and we offer our clients, when they leave our facility, a 12-month aftercare program that's called a balanced life. Mm-hmm. And so we have folks in our call center. Again, we're taking 19 to 20,000 calls a month, incoming calls. We also have a team of people who do follow-ups with our clients who leave our facility. And let's say you leave our Dallas area facility. Our Dallas area facility is called the Treehouse. It's where I went. We do yoga classes in an actual treehouse, and outdoor therapy and zip line courses and cooking therapy and all these great things. But when you go home, you're going to have an individual in our call center call you and text you on a daily or weekly basis with follow-up calls and text messages to make sure that you're on track with your aftercare plan. If you're struggling with.
Yeah.
So we have folks that'll leave treatment after 30 or 60 days, and they had a great treatment. They had a great experience, and they go home and they don't have a car because they got a DUI and they can't get to a 12-step meeting. Well, that's a barrier. That's an obstacle. And some people just give up right then, and they're going to go back to their heroin dealer's house and shoot up heroin because they can't get to a 12-step meeting. Well, we're going to have somebody follow up with you on a daily basis and a weekly basis and give you weekly coaching calls, online coaching calls, where you're going to be able to say, hey, man, I'm struggling getting to a 12-step meeting. And you can tell somebody in real time what your obstacle is. And we can have somebody on our end of the phone going, hey, all right, well, who's somebody that you can call? Can I call an Uber for you? I'll call an Uber for you. We will do whatever we can to help you stay sober. And so, we're going to help remove those barriers for individuals so that they can, it's all about keeping people connected longer term, as best as possible. And not just in 30 days and going to keep somebody sober. It's the follow-up. And a lot of most treatment centers don't do that long-term aftercare that we do.
Yeah, I think that's awesome, really awesome what you just said there, because I think the follow-up, John, is, it's hard enough, I'm an ex-smoker, for example. For years ago, I stopped smoking, but, you go back in to the real world and you see all your friends smoke, and it's really, really hard to stay strong. So I love what you're saying, that this campus is really guiding people afterwards to not fall, but to succeed. That's the whole purpose. Yep. So, John, how can people, unfortunately, we're very close to the time. I know an hour goes really, really fast. How can people, how can people connect with you?
So, again, addictioncampuses.com. You can call our 800 number, talk to a treatment specialist right now, 24 hours a day. You can't call this minute. And that number is 888-614-2251. Again, 888-614-2251. My name is John Mabry, and you can connect with me on social media platforms at John, J-O-H-N, Clint, C-L-I-N-T, Mabry, M-A-B-R-Y. Again, John Clint Mabry on all social media platforms if you want to shoot me a personal message or connect with me on social media.
And you have a podcast, right? What is your podcast called? Your name?
Yeah, it's called High Sobriety. If you go to Addiction Campuses, our podcast is called High Sobriety, and I'm the host of that. And we've got all kinds of cool celebrities and authors and experts in the field of addiction and mental health. So please check out High Sobriety.
Super. Thank you so much, John. It was an incredible pleasure to have you on this show, and I hope you come back with more information, because there's at least 5 more questions I want to ask you. So,
Well, thank you, Gabriella.
Please stay in touch, because this is an important topic, very important.
Thank you, and God bless you and the work that you're doing.
Thank you. And for everyone out there, the listener, please put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday, when our special guest will be Sarah Ann Shockley to discuss her new book, The Pain Companion, Everyday Wisdom for Living With and Moving Beyond Chronic Pain. And please visit the archives of our past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or better yet, subscribe to the show through iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will help us to reach more people, and it will be greatly appreciated by us all. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by the Answers for the Family page and check out some of the latest posts. Thank you so much for spreading the word, and have a great week.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.